Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is your host, Monk. You can find out more by emailing me. The website is up, but it's being rebuilt, so it's a little bit not quite up to date. Today is a book review. Fascinating, informative, very well written, and very disturbing read. Yet if you're interested in the topic, the insights and information make up for the disturbance. It's by Joseph Zulaika, Zulaika, and published by University of California Press, called Hellfire from Paradise Ranch, on the front lines of drone warfare. I'll read the book flap explanation because it's excellently sums it up. In this intimate and innovative work, terror expert Joseba Zulaika examines drone warfare as manhunting carried out via satellite. Using Creech Air Force Base near Las Vegas as his center of study, he interviews former drone operators as well as resistors to the war economy of the region to expose the layers of fantasy on which counter-terrorism and its self-sustaining logic are grounded. Hellfire from Paradise Ranch exposes the terror and warfare of drone killings that dominate the modern U.S. military. It unveils the trauma that drone operators experience in part due to their visual intimacy with their victims and explores the resistance to drone killings in the same apocalyptic Nevada desert where nuclear testing, pacifist militancy, and Shoshone tradition overlap. It's actually Shoshone Native people's lands. Stunning and absorbing, this book offers a richly detailed account of how we continue, we being a U.S. empire, to manufacture, deconstruct, and perpetuate terror. One of the interesting things, as he mentions the intimacy, is that there's a odd juxtaposition of the kind of video game approach to the drone warfare, meaning a push a button and people are killed, and then the drone, the operators of that technology, because of the camera, however, the drone camera actually being able to see the people up close. And this is caused in the book, there are two examples of the drone operators who are now outspoken kind of whistleblowers. Those are the only ones who could be interviewed for the book. Speaking out against the horror and the war crimes and the murder. And here's a quote from the Nobel Peace Prize winner. Himself boasted that, quote, "It turns out that I'm really good at killing. Didn't know that was going to be a strong suit of mine," end quote. That's former President Obama. The book does get into a chapter about the dilemma that he faced, as in kind of Harvard background, intelligence, you know, his level of intelligence getting into the role as president. And part of the reasoning behind perhaps his statements is that the book gets into explaining the kind of way that the drone killing is presented as preventing other troubles and preventing terrorists, but also, as the book shows, there actually is creating more terrorists and creating more problems. The way that it gets justified is under national security, and some of the mode of that is linguistics. In other words, renaming, I think one of the phrases is extrajudicial, meaning outside of the law, because it's special case of potential terrorism kind of thing. And then Zulaika writes, "Thus the first step toward the new conceptual paradigm is linguistic, and naming it becomes inaugural. Indeed, as argued elsewhere, the rhetorical arts of naming, categorizing, defining, and plotting are foundational to the required new reality-making discourse of counter-terrorism." Interestingly, in Michelle Alexander's best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, she points out that the the war on drugs, before that started, drug use was going down. So I dubbed that the war of drugs. And in this case, for a long time, I have dubbed it the global war of terror, not global war on terror. As Gore Vidal pointed out years ago, that trying to name a war on an abstract noun is equivalent of saying war on dandruff. And he also points out how there are agencies within agencies, so it's hard to kind of pinpoint who's actually doing some stuff. Like he refers to the quote counter-terrorist elite within the CIA. It's not the CIA that primarily operates the black box Arkin writes, but a counter-terrorist elite within the CIA. In this world, the result is incredible secrecy and an alliance with people more powerful than those in delegated positions of power. He also gets into the psychological background of the people doing the drone operators. There's a level of what he calls erotic transference, a kind of wartime, literal, sometimes hard-on, in doing the deeds, the nasty deeds. And also gets into the levels of comparing it to the more traditional warfare of hunting, psychology of considering people subhuman, and the whole vague and fantasy levels of the people because you know, are they actually terrorists? Is there a justification behind it? So a kind of fantasy gets built up. And some of the truly tragic is that a large percentage of the drone bomb killings affected, and sometimes deliberately affected, or casually deliberately affected, women, children, weddings, funerals. As to the shift that's needed, Zuleika writes, let's see, someone he's referring to as Ling. Ling meets with the survivors of February 21, 2010, Creech-guided drone attack that targeted and killed 23 family members. The operation whose declassified radio transcripts we saw in the chapter on hunting. The survivors recount for her in detail how things unfolded. After the first group was struck, they lifted the children to the sky so the pilots could see they weren't fighters, but the bombing continued. Ling tells how the survivors told her that they forgave me for the part I played in what happened to them, and that's amazing. You can see people's hearts. I just want people to know that not everybody is a freaking terrorist, and we just need to get out of that mindset. We need to see these people as people, families, communities, brothers, mothers, and sisters, because that's what they are. Imagine if this was happening to us. End quote. It was the traumatized executioner facing her victims in horror. That, by the way, is what transformed the well-known writer, activist, Professor Howard Zinn. He was a bombardier in World War II, I think it was, and was dropping bombs and I think napalm, and eventually he got to the ground in Europe and somehow met with some of the people and the families, and he became a pacifist and went on to be very much outspoken and a well-known pacifist and activist who is missed today. Another issue is the intense amount of PTSD from the pilots and war veterans and former drone pilots, and statistics on that reveal the 23% of the annual 45,000 suicides in America are veterans. So that's a very unspoken issue. As the war gets this patriotic fervor, what does not get as much attention are the trauma and the veterans that get left by the wayside and on the streets begging for change if they can. Spare change, you know, and literal change, I would say. And another thing I found in the redeeming aspect, what I call an adage, that he's referring here to two of the drone operator pilots who come clean. For Westmoreland, Bryant, and many other former and current drone operators, as well as for the followers of Day, King, it's Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King, or Vital, protesting at Creech, and the NTS, and for the scientists who developed the bomb, as well as cold warriors such as Kennan, McNamara, Ellsberg, or Perry who brought the world to the brink of apocalypse, the one redeeming truth is that you must first experience history as trauma in order to transform your thinking and turn your body into resistance. What is happening in their own land under the banner of the American Dream has turned for them into a traumatic symptom archived in their own bodies. It is a past calling to the present for redemption and demanding works of love and a new way of thinking. But I found that important line, you must first experience history as trauma in order to transform your thinking and turn your body into resistance. And I'll wrap up with saying the underlying truth that's mentioned a little bit in the book, I wish it was mentioned more, but I am quite glad that it was mentioned, is that much of this testing and previous testing has taken place on Shoshone lands. There's an excellent book by Winona LaDuc with Sean Cruz. I think it's called The Militarization of Indian Country, where she gets into the details of uranium mining used for bombs and warfare and leaving toxic residue. Here's the footnote quote. Between 1951 and 1956, 49 nuclear bombs were exploded in southern Nevada. Area 51 was in place for the 1957 Operation Plumb Bob, a series of 30 nuclear explosions. Plumb Bob tests dropped fallout from Oregon to New England. 1/1000th of a gram of plutonium is enough to kill a person. As part of the Operation Plumb Bob, on July 5, 1957, the Hood bomb was tested. Its flash, seen from Canada to Mexico and 800 miles out to sea, lighted and shook the pre-dawn darkness. It took 25 minutes for the nuclear wave to travel 350 miles west to Los Angeles, and the Army conducted various other tests during the explosion. Above-ground testing continued until July of 1962. So the Shoshone area in Nevada, was now called Nevada, is one of the most bomb-tested areas, if not the most, in the world. So the madness of this is obvious. So it's, but aside from the intensity of some of that, it's a very interesting book. Getting, like I said, getting into the psychology behind what gets people to do this and how they respond to that. So I think it gives an opening into the potential solutions, and also the last chapter does make an interesting comparison of Obama with, he compares it to the Iliad and to the biblical reference of Abraham being tested and when he's about to willing to sacrifice his son Isaac, and he compares that to to Obama and the military industrial complex that make a justification for the drone bombings and other military. And I'll end with this bit because it's about the Shoshone. We were on Shoshone land occupied by the U.S. military. The government's appropriation of Western Shoshone land has its own history of unilateral decisions, misunderstandings, and legal deceptions, all of which favored the occupiers. The Shoshone never ceded their rights to the land, and according to Johnny, I think he's a spokesperson or chief or somebody like that. According to Johnny, the 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley, a treaty of peace and friendship that confirmed Indian titles to specific territories and safe passage for immigrants traveling through Shoshone lands, remains in effect. So that's the kind of rectification that needs to happen as far as the land and the consciousness and the society. So thank you very much for listening. Be peaceful and be well.